Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Nigeria's President Bola Tinubu is yet to replace the ambassadors who were recalled a year ago. We'll get insights and some advice from a former Nigerian ambassador.
If I were in the ministry right now, if I were foreign minister, what I would do would be to persuade the powers that be, the president, that the missions in our key trading partners should be open. Well, I mean the ambassadors should be appointed to our different trading partners while the others can wait. But unfortunately, this is not being done.
And how the art of winemaking in South Africa is having to adapt to climate change. It's Monday, October 7th. First, we go to Mozambique. The country is set to hold crucial presidential and legislative elections on October 9th, that's in the next 2 days. The polls come at a critical time as the Southern African nation faces a number of economic and security issues. The outcome will greatly impact Mozambique's future as citizens hope for stability and positive change. So why are Mozambique elections so important, and what key issues should you know about? Here's an explainer from my colleague Bella Hassan.
Mozambique is preparing for elections on October 9th. There are four main presidential candidates, but most analysts expect the ruling party Frelimo to remain in power. Frelimo has governed the country since its independence in 1975. One of the biggest issues surrounding this election is the ongoing conflict in Cabo Delgado, a northern province where Islamic State-linked militants have been carrying out attacks since 2017. This region is home to some of the world's largest gas reserves, and the insurgency here has forced over 1 million people to flee their homes. The ongoing conflict has disrupted massive gas projects that could have transformed Mozambique's economy. The country has also been ranked as one of the most climate-vulnerable countries in Africa. Devastating cyclones have regularly hit it. In addition to all of this, Mozambique is still reeling from a financial scandal known as the Tuna Bond Scandal, which involved over $1.5 billion. The money, borrowed by state-owned companies, was meant to be used for building efficient fleet and improve maritime security. However, much of it has disappeared due to corruption and mismanagement. Top officials, including government figures, were implicated. Mozambique maintained that it was the victim of a conspiracy among shipbuilders, corrupt officials, and banks. The scandal triggered criminal investigations from Mobutu to New York. While senior Frelimo politicians were charged for their involvement, dealing a blow to the party's image. With climate challenge, an unresolved Islamist insurgency in the north, and the ongoing economic troubles, this election remains highly significant.
Thanks, Bella. So those are the issues at stake. This is also an important election for Mozambique because it marks a shift away from the leadership of people involved in the country's liberation struggle leading up to its independence from Portugal in 1975. Take the presidential candidate from the ruling Frelimo party, for example, 47-year-old Daniel Chapo. It's the first time Frelimo is fielding a candidate who was born after independence. If you want to dig into the politics, I'd recommend checking out an episode of the Africa Daily podcast where they looked at this in depth. We, however, are going to hone in on a different issue, the question of insecurity, especially in the northern Cabo Delgado province where an insurgency has been raging. To find out about its impact on the election, I've been speaking to Adriano Nuvunga, political science lecturer at the University of Eduardo Mondlane in Maputo and the director of the Center for Democracy and Development.
Security in Mozambique is stable. We have an insurgency in northern Cabo Delgado. The insurgency is very localized in the northern part of the province of Cabo Delgado. But the rest of the country is stable. It has different sort of challenges, but security-wise, it is okay.
So insecurity in Cabo Delgado province, do the rest of the people in the rest of the country, is this something that they talk about, think about? Because certainly they do hear about it quite a lot in the news.
Obviously, they do. They do. They know it. They look at it more from the humanitarian perspective. About 1 million people are now in the condition of IDPs. So that is one of the biggest humanitarian crises since the signing of the peace agreement in 1992. They also do talk about it from the perspective of the domestic mobilization of resources. As you know, that region is home for Mozambique's well-declared gas reserves. Now, the insurgency is sitting in between the people of Mozambique and harnessing that resource for domestic mobilization. So that's where the issue becomes a top issue.
So let's go back to the people there, the most affected by the Islamist insurgency. Will they be getting a chance to vote in the election?
This is a major question. There are two issues related to this. Number one, the electoral institution has come out to say that it does not have the necessary budget to make sure that everybody will be able to vote. So they are in budget deficit, which is a major concern. You know, Mozambique is a massive country, population is widespread, and it needs heavy logistics to meet everybody so that they can exercise their constitutional right of participating in this election. So there is this issue. The second issue is, as you have indicated, the Cabo Delgado war. Remember, in 2019, in one or two districts, people were unable to vote. And we expect a similar pattern in the northern district, Macomia, Palma, all the way to the border with Tanzania, which are the areas affected by the violent extremism. As I'm speaking now, there are military activities there that will not only affect the communities in those districts, but also, and fundamentally, it will affect the IDPs. There's been an effort to register IDPs to be able to vote. But the reality is that those people in a situation of IDPs, they face extra obstacles to be able to meaningfully participate in the election.
And would there be concerns that militants may as well target the electoral process?
There is no doubt about that. In 2019, we have experiences of that happening, where in the early stage of the insurgency, people were prevented from casting the vote due to insecurity as the military activity was threatening the integrity of the election there. And we indeed do expect that with the expansion of the attacks by the international forces and the Mozambican forces to violent extremists, they can indeed organize to make it difficult for the people to participate as a form of retaliation to the ongoing targeting by the international forces.
So the insurgency in Cabo Delgado, why has it been so difficult to solve? And what is it that the next president of Mozambique can do to bring a solution to this?
That insurgency in the north is so difficult to solve because it's a governance issue. You mentioned about extremist groups. They are said to be extremists because of the horrendous crimes that they have committed. But those young people there, they are a product of a failed governance related to unlawful, non-developmental and elite-centric extractivism of the resources. So unless the next president, he sets governance right in terms of improving transparency, improving inclusive national and local dialogue through democratic means, and also allowing that local districts, they have a fair share of the national resources, that conflict will not end, regardless of the bombardments that the current government is making with the support of the Rwandese government.
Okay. Thank you, Adriano, for coming to the program.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Thank you.
That's Adriano Nuvunga in Mozambique. What does it mean for a country to be without ambassadors? Well, Nigeria has been without them for over a year. Last year, President Bola Tinubu recalled all Nigeria's ambassadors who were representing the country's diplomatic missions, embassies and consulates globally, and he has yet to replace them. In April this year, 12 consuls general and 5 chargés d'affaires were assigned to 14 countries. However, in May, the Minister of Foreign Affairs attributed the delay to appointing new ambassadors to a lack of funds. I've been speaking to Professor Akinjide Oshuntokun, who is a Nigerian academic and a former ambassador to Germany from 1991 to 1995. For a country like Nigeria, an important actor on both the African and global stage, how unusual is this?
It is rather unusual, but I think there are circumstances that could lead to such a gap in diplomatic representation at the very top. But it doesn't mean that we don't have our missions. We have missions, our missions are open, and if there are important messages to be passed between governments and governments, our missions are ready for business.
Has this ever occurred before in Nigeria's diplomatic history?
Not really. There may have been instances where we did not have ambassadors in one country or the other, but not a blanket situation like this.
So why has it taken then so long to replace these ambassadors after the previous ones were recalled?
It is because there is a new government and the circumstances prevailing in the country, particularly the economic circumstances, require that a thorough reform in representation be made and a thorough assessment of the economic well-being of the country is being made. So it's partly economic. The situation is because of the economic problems that we have. And please don't forget that we have embassies in more than 100 countries, and this requires general funding. And it requires being funded from foreign reserves. If the reserves of the country are a bit low, then there is a problem. We don't want to send missions abroad and not be properly funded.
You said, though, in your previous answer that the missions are still there. Where are they drawing their funding if the missions are still there? But what does it mean to have a mission present but not to have an ambassador? And what does it mean financially?
Well, the ambassador is the top of the mission. And when you send an ambassador abroad, you send him with his family. And if you don't have your own residences or buildings, you will have to rent. And this requires a lot of money because he has to be seen to be living in a very good area. Now, if you send an ambassador, say, to Tokyo or Washington or London, luckily in those countries that I've mentioned, we have residences. We have our own buildings. But then he still requires to pay, and if he has children below the age of 18, to be educated at the expense of the country's exchequer. So this requires considerable amount of funding in hard currency. It's not that we will not eventually post ambassadors abroad, but for now, it is better to have missions headed by our heads of mission ad interim, which is cheaper.
I'm just wondering, because you yourself, you've been an ambassador before to Germany for Nigeria between 1991 and 1995. Is
yes.
this the only place where Nigeria could have saved money, given the economic situation that you're describing?
It's not, but let me tell you a little bit about the positions of ambassadors in contemporary times. The positions are actually superfluous. I'm saying this as an academic. If there are serious problems to be discussed between one country and the other, between the president or prime minister of one country and the other, it may not even go through the ambassadors. If there are serious things to be discussed, it's either the two heads of countries will call each other, or lower than that, the ministers will speak directly to each other. The position of an ambassador is a traditional position. And if a country can't afford this luxury for the moment, it can delay it. And this is what is happening.
Do you mean to say then, Professor, that the lack of ambassadors or Nigerian ambassadors in this country, some of which are quite, you know, close allies of the country, has no diplomatic impact at all? Whatever business needs to be done can still be done, whether they are appointed or not.
What I'm saying is that those missions are headed by what you call head of missions ad interim. It doesn't mean that the missions are closed. Eventually, ambassadors will be appointed, and things will go on as before. If a mission were to be closed, then we are talking about something different. We have more than 100 missions all over the world. If I were in the ministry right now, if I were foreign minister, what I would do would be to persuade the powers that be, the president, that the missions in our key trading partners should be opened. Well, I mean the ambassadors should be appointed to our different trading partners, while the others can wait. But unfortunately, this is not being done.
An ambassador today, once appointed, what is it that they do? What is the value that they bring to the country?
Now, are you asking me this as an academic or as a former ambassador?
Both. Try create a balance for us, Professor, because you've done both.
Well, as an academic, I'm sure my former friends in the diplomatic service would not like what I'm saying. I'm saying that the position of an ambassador is actually superfluous. It goes back to the history of exchange of ambassadors. Ambassadors in the past, you know, because this thing started in Europe, were either princes or brothers of the king or queen. And whatever he says is almost done. Right now, no ambassador, even though they are extraordinary and plenipotentiary, no ambassador can really commit his or her country to safe to war. Whereas in the old days, the position of ambassadors were really critical. The position today is a traditional position. You know, there are so many things that are traditional. Flying the flag is a traditional recognition of sovereignty. It doesn't mean that if you don't fly the flag, somebody will not appreciate the fact that you are a sovereign country. The position of an ambassador is a traditional position. It's a very important position. It shows the prominence of the country sending an ambassador abroad. I have seen situations where ambassadors of some countries were living in penury because their own government were not funding them. I've witnessed this. I don't think we will want to be in that kind of position. It's better to make sure that when we send ambassadors abroad, he will be funded. And an ambassador is very effective if he can have social interaction, if he can invite members of the community where he's serving to parties in his house, to dinners, you know. Does he have money? He cannot do this. This is what I'm saying.
Yeah. So in the position that Nigeria has been without ambassadors in all of these countries, is there anything at stake in terms of relationships with those countries or relationships with multilateral organizations such as the African Union or the United Nations, for example?
I don't think so, but I'm sure people in the current government are considering sending ambassadors abroad, particularly to key institutions that you have mentioned and to key trading partners. We have about 52 missions in Africa, you know, that are headed by ambassadors. If we don't have ambassadors in such countries right now, it will not diminish. or derogate from the importance of Nigeria in Africa. It would only mean that those missions are headed temporarily by UNBOS ad interim. It does not mean that Nigeria has not been adequately represented. If there are important things to decide, the foreign minister, who is the principal agent of the president, will be sent out to go and carry out those important missions. Positions of ambassadors are more or less decorative.
Is that how you felt, Professor, when you were in Germany in 1991 to 1995? Did you feel, you know, it was more of a decoration, like you're saying, it was superfluous?
Yes, there was no doubt about that. If decisions were going to be taken, they will read whatever brief you have sent to them in the head office, in the presidency. Don't forget, the foreign policy of a country is the policy of the president. Ambassadors, foreign ministers, and others are agents of the president. You will just be one of those people, you know, your own brief into the mix from which a decision will be taken. And when a decision is taken, you will be so informed. But it's a traditional position that has been on, and there is no need to stop it. But if any country really wants to save money, it will reduce the number of missions that it has. Many of our countries in Africa don't even have missions all over the world. There are countries, colleagues of mine, who had triple or quadruple representation. They'd be accredited to Germany, to France, to Belgium, to the European Union, all at the same time.
Thank you, Professor, for your input and for your thoughts. It's very, very interesting listening to you.
Thank you very much.
Here is an alternative view to the one we've just heard. It's from Emmanuel Remy Ayede, a professor of political institutions, governance and public policy. What does he think?
I think that it's a mark of the sluggishness of this government in attending to a variety of challenges confronting it. And it has very negative implications for foreign policy implementation as far as Nigeria is concerned in some very important foreign countries and within international organizations. The debate about the expansion of the Security Council is ongoing. Then you see how unfortunate it is that Nigeria is unable to maintain ambassadors in strategic countries over the last 1 year.
Many thanks to Professors Akinjide Oshuntokun and Emmanuel Remy Ayede for their views. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
The most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
We move to a part of South Africa, the Western Cape, known for producing wine, which has been a significant part of the region's economy, cultural identity, and tourism. However, this flourishing industry is under a growing threat as rising temperatures, shifting rainfall patterns, and the increasing frequency of extreme weather patterns reshape the landscape of winemaking. So how is this all impacting the industry in South Africa? Emma Karkik is a vineyard consultant at VinPro, a non-profit organization that represents the interests of South African wine producers, sellers, and wine-related businesses. So, Emma, what kind of climatic balance do you then need to be able to produce a good wine as a region or as a country?
That's a tough one to answer, because what makes South Africa's wine-growing regions so interesting is our really variable topography. We have really differing topography over different areas, which creates these interesting different climates in each region. So every region is different in what it's used to, but I think that what's making things tough, if one has to look at it over the broader South African wine industry, is just the rainfall events events, the rainfall's erratic, we have heat spikes. So it's the variability. It's less constant conditions than we perhaps were used to in the past. So I think what would be an ideal climate is a difficult question to answer. It's nice, sort of even growing or ripening conditions. It's really good, nice, cold, wet weather in winter, and then an early enough, and then warmer weather in spring, but with still a bit of rainfall so that we can keep the soil wet for longer so that it doesn't dry out too early in the spring season.
Is South Africa unique to the rest of the continent, and these changes in climate, is it something that's happening now? How new is it? Or is it something that has been evolving over a long period of time?
I think perhaps it has been evolving over a longer period of time, but certainly events in the past, in the shorter term, have really been quite challenging. There is an increased degree of change. And I think the biggest issue for us is just the unpredictability and the extremeness of the events that we're dealing with. South African wine growers are used to tough conditions, and we have been adapting for a long time. We just really have to ramp up our adaptive practices. And what's good about facing these challenges is that it forces innovation. We really do have to be innovative in how we think about planting new vineyards and what to plant, and planting the right things in the right places, the right cultivars, the right rootstocks, and implementing the right vineyard practices.
What's the impact then on the quality of the wine, the taste, the volume of how much can be produced?
Well, if we talk about in season, I think use the last season as a reference, we had extremely windy conditions in the growing season, and it was very dry with a few heat spikes. It's hard for the vineyard managers or the viticulturists and the farmers to manage those events. One has to be really good with irrigation and your canopy management practices, because you want to prevent a sort of a dehydration of the berries, of the grape berries, and you want to manage or keep your canopy in a good condition. So what can happen is that if those aren't handled correctly or you don't put the right practices in place, you can have dehydration and the berries lose, they end up being in a poorer condition. You get a bit of sunburn, a bit of shriveling, and it can ultimately affect the alcohol content of the wine, but that's in extreme cases.
Okay.
And it can obviously affect the flavor profile of the wine, because you ideally are looking for a constant, slower ripening process with more constant conditions, more moderate conditions, so that you can have a longer ripening process. Whereas if you have these very dry conditions and very hot weather, you don't get that. It sort of speeds up that ripening without allowing the grapes to develop all the full aroma and flavor profile that one is ultimately going for.
You've been describing about how, you know, you're adapting to the issues in South Africa. What does that look like in terms of actual measures? And what does that then mean for things like labor or the cost of producing the wine?
My focus area is a project called the Gen Z Project. And in this project, we are working to try and provide the wine growers with knowledge and answers on how better to adapt to changing climate and how to enhance or optimize their production. So we have a lot of what we call interplanting demos. So they are demonstration blocks within commercial vineyards in across the winelands on different soil types and different climatic zones. And we're really trying to evaluate the performance of different cultivars, varieties, and rootstocks in order to share that information with the farmers so that when they decide that they need to plant a new block, they are equipped with all the information needed to make the right decisions when planting. Because the biggest part of having a grapevine that is buffered against climate change is the correct establishment of that vine and the correct selection of cultivar and rootstock.
What are cultivars?
So the cultivar is the variety. So Shiraz or Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, Tavar, those are cultivars. And within cultivars, we have different clones. So within our project, we are also looking at different clones of varieties. They have different traits within that cultivar. So a clone of Chardonnay or a clone of Cabernet Sauvignon may ripen earlier than another clone, or it may have a different grape or bunch morphology, may have tighter bunches or longer bunches. They're small differences, but they make a difference in terms of decision making, and especially in the flavor profile and the production. Some clones produce a bit more, some produce a bit less, but maybe a higher quality. So that selection process is so critical in your decision making when you establish a new vineyard, because vineyards are incredibly expensive to establish. You only get your production over 4 years, so it's a long-term investment. So you have to make the right decisions at the beginning with all the information.
I'll go back again to the adaptation measures that you've described. Yes. Does it mean more people working in a vineyard? Does it mean more costs for the people running the business? And for somebody who likes to enjoy a glass or a bottle of wine, does it mean they will pay more?
It may mean more costs involved, or higher expenses on the grower's part. There are mitigation strategies. For example, if you really want to manage your soil in the best way to harness the rain that we're having erratic rainfall, so you really want to make the most of the rain that falls, you really need to build up your soil carbon in order to harvest that rain and to hold onto it and not lose it. And part of that is planting cover crops that may be a higher cost than normal, or putting a mulch down, putting compost down, or you know, those kind of strategies can incur higher costs. I wouldn't say that there's necessarily too big an impact on labor, but there may ultimately be a carryover into the final wine price. And from a South African point of view, that really should happen anyway, because the South African wines are extremely good value for money. And yeah, I think that farming inputs are becoming increasingly expensive. Every year, the increase is huge, but the wine prices don't adjust as much as the input costs do.
And that's vineyard consultant Emma Karkik. Focus on Africa was put together by Rob Wilson and Bella Hassan in London. Blessing Aderoba was in Lagos. The senior journalist overseeing the production was Carney Sharp, and Jack Graysmark was the technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. We'll speak again soon.
He owned iconic luxury brands.
Harrods was the ultimate glamorous shop.
Most famous people in the world coming there.
But Mohammed Al-Fayed used his wealth and power to control more than just his business interests.
Mohammed Al-Fayed was like an apex predator.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al-Fayed, Predator at Harrods, from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.